Hello and welcome to Compass Live, the only and therefore the best live stream dedicated to proof of work mining. We got a stellar cast here today. The Coinmetrics team has graciously given their time to us to talk about the last year in Bitcoin mining. So we got a lot of data coming at you hot and heavy. We're going to go through some analytics, some research from the Coinmetrics team. Before we dive into that, I want to thank Zach for jumping on the stream. How are you doing today?
Doing well. This is full house. It's going to be a fun conversation. Obviously, nobody better to talk crypto data, Bitcoin mining data than the Coinmetrics team. No shame in shilling. We use them for all of our content. I have used them in previous roles too. The best data there is, pretty much. Actually, not even pretty much. Don't need to add that caveat there. So super glad to have not just their data on our screens, but some of their staff on our stream today. I think, you know, there's a ton of different data points and data sets that have fueled pretty impactful narratives throughout Bitcoin over the past year. And it'll be exciting to dig into some of those and look back on the past 12 months and see what's happened.
Totally. Well put. Yeah, we got a really awesome cast today. And just in terms of introductions, Nate Madry is a senior research analyst at Coinmetrics. Kyle Waters, a research analyst. And Parker Marriott, a customer success manager. I want to welcome all three of you to the stream today. And of course, we're talking Bitcoin mining, kind of a review of the data thus far. Still got about 3 weeks left. But you know, there's been a lot of narratives and a lot of stories played out in the data this year. So excited to go through it with you guys. Thanks for joining us on the stream.
Yeah, thanks for having us, guys. We're excited to get into it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, so I want to start off with like probably the question you were very much so expecting, which is hash rate has almost totally recovered from the China ban earlier this year. I sent a message this morning in Slack to Zach and the rest of the content team and said like, hey, hash rate's basically recovered. Should we like tweet about it or do something like that? And Zach, of course, sends a message back. Well, like what's your moving average on that sample and like what's your variance? And it's, that's like totally the correct response, right? Because it's not necessarily like we're not totally back yet or we don't technically know just because that's how the data works. But I think it is something that we should kind of highlight here at the top of the stream that hash rate is back. And I want to ask all three of you, did you expect hash rate to recover this fast from June when China banned? Kyle, maybe we'll start off with you. We can kind of do a round robin, Parker and then Nate.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so like you said, if you look at the data, it's quite a stark bounce back from the trough in earlier this year. So yeah, I mean, I think I was taken a little bit by surprise. When you think about, you know, the just massive amount of just hardware that needs to be moved around and just, you know, some of the predictions around like where geographically some of the rigs would go from China, it's quite a profound turnaround. And so, you know, I think part of that is just a broader narrative around new versus existing rigs coming online that I know I'm sure we can kind of talk about and you guys have a really good perspective on as well. And has been discussed a lot. So yeah, I mean, just when you think about a lot of the supply chain issues and, you know, people talking about chip shortages, I think, yeah, it's pretty, pretty remarkable that it's back to where it is, to where it was before the ban.
I'll echo that. I was definitely caught a little bit off guard. Damien, I think the third from the left there we go. Yeah. So this is my favorite time for to look at hash rate growth. And actually we are at new all-time highs on the weekly average there. I definitely didn't expect it to rebound this quickly. You know, I think that the thing I discounted though was, and the thing most people overlook is all this hash rate that we've seen like on the rebound here from July to date is not entirely or even mostly like hash rate from China. This is all hash rate from North American farms and projects that are coming online that have been in under development for the past 6, 12, 18, 24 months. A chunk of it, yeah, is hash rate relocating from China to Kazakhstan, parts of Latin America and elsewhere. But a lot of Chinese miners, ASICs, still offline. And I definitely didn't expect this huge rebound as quickly as we've seen it. Like, I mean, hash rate, if anything, just goes up and to the right for eternity. But I didn't expect this rebound as quickly as we've seen it.
Yeah, I would completely agree. You know, I think just this China ban was such a hyper local event. You know, we were in the midst of this 4-year halving cycle. So everybody was still pretty bullish, you know, especially in the Western hemisphere. So I think if you understood how good the band was for Bitcoin long term, you know, there were a lot of institutional investors that were ready to gobble up that hash. You know, mining has reached this institutional maturity. It's viewed as sort of a safe way to profit from Bitcoin without taking a direct position in it. You've got players like Foundry and Galaxy that have a lot more, you know, institutional and financing support. So I was certainly expecting, you know, Western and institutional investors to seize this opportunity, but the rate at which it's bounced back is certainly incredible.
Yeah, and I agree with pretty much everything you guys said. I expected it to bounce back and be okay, especially given what Parker was saying, how we saw this huge bifurcation just between China and the US and kind of the rest of the Western world. So in the long term, I think it's a really healthy thing. First of all, that some of that has a concentrated hash rate is moving out of China, it's moving to the West. But also it just shows the resiliency of Bitcoin, how quickly it bounced back. But all that being said, I definitely was not expecting it to happen this fast. And also just a little shout out to Zach for asking about the to what time frame you're looking at the hash rate on and kind of what moving average. That's when we're actually looking at that hash rate data, it's actually very difficult to measure hash rate directly. So what we're doing is we're kind of estimating hash rate based on block time. So if you're just looking at like daily hash rate, you could see a lot of variance on there based on block time. But given that 7-day and even 30-day hash rate is back above where it was in May, that's a really good sign that hash rate is pretty much fully recovered.
Yeah, obviously super bullish for the network there with the little price dip we've seen lately and difficulty increases coming from this hash rate recovery. Miners, you know, hash price is down a little bit from where it was 30 or 60 days ago, but not too much of a drop to worry about. Unless we have any other comments on hash rate, I kind of wanted to move on to, and maybe annoyingly so, but it's something that I've just kind of been watching and curious about throughout the entire, second half of this year. And that's Bitcoin's mempool. Damien, if you don't mind zooming out to the 1-year time frame on this, it's like this time frame is one of my favorites just because you see it's like night and day here. Like the first half of the year, obviously some solid levels, a little bit of variance. Then after July, it's just empty. And, you know, in that summer period there, we had a lot of things going on, obviously. Some protocol upgrade announcements forthcoming, some big companies upgrading their internal operations, obviously, China news and a huge hash rate shuffle. But just like this chart, there's no single answer or in my opinion, like solid answer for why this is the way that it is. The thing that this chart doesn't show is on top of the mempool, sort of the inflow of transactions in the network, the actual confirmed transactions are also, you know, dropping, still significantly below levels that they were at prior, in earlier in the year. So I just want to toss this to you guys. I don't know, how often or how much you guys think about mempool levels and transaction levels. But like, what are your craziest or most reasonable theories for, you know, why the mempool in H2 looks so much different than it does January through June, I guess? Anybody, whoever wants to take a stab at it first.
Yeah, it's tricky. This is something that we've discussed a lot internally as well, and we don't have any great answers either. It's confusing, especially because obviously after May, that drop off makes sense just because after that crash, there are less speculators, less people trading. So you're going to see, you know, a big drop off. But then kind of between May and July is a little confusing because there's a little bit of bounce back and then it just drops completely off after July. So I'm not sure exactly what happened after July. Some of our best theories are that batching transactions has gotten more prevalent. But looking at the data, we actually have a couple charts on that. It doesn't seem like that's actually had too big of an impact. Batching hasn't increased by too much. Some other ideas are that maybe exchanges have made some changes to be more efficient with the transactions they're doing, although we also don't have too much data for that. And yeah, other than that, just like speculators leaving and not coming back. But other than that, I'm not really too sure.
Yeah. Kyle, Parker, any thoughts on this? Like I echo Nate. I have, you know, several ideas for things that may be like partial catalysts to this, but I don't have any solid ideas. I think the biggest thing that's... the biggest announcement is probably blockchain.com upgrading to SegWit. And that could have an effect on the mempool weight and levels here. But, you know, if that's responsible for this big of a change, that's like probably more concerning than it is good that blockchain finally made that upgrade. I don't know. Any thoughts from you guys?
I mean, I think as a Bitcoiner, certainly, you know, the explanation I prefer is that Lightning Network has just caught on fire. And, you know, if you do look at the adoption between the number of nodes online, the channels, and, you know, the actual amount of Bitcoin locked up, you know, clearly we've seen some substantial growth on the Lightning Network side. We've also got a lot more sort of pseudo L2s like Cash App that are, you know, payment networks first, Bitcoin exchanges second. So that could certainly be related as well. I think ultimately, you know, just like the mempool congestion levels, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there, but, you know, many people will tell you that they were overly inflated just due to spam attacks from some of the more aggressive miners during the most politically heated periods in Bitcoin's history. So I think that's a contributing factor as well. So again, you know, a mix of issues there, but yeah, you know, it's hard to pin down, especially because Lightning is so opaque as a payment network.
Yeah, to echo all those things. And, you know, again, it's when you think about maybe looking at the active supply to down the network and think about some of the narratives around Bitcoin right now and maybe just less activity in general. So, you know, then we would obviously see that in the mempool.
Yeah, I think I agree with all of that. And Parker, especially, like my preferred narrative is, you know, massive L2 adoption. And, you know, like obviously we can't explain all of this with that, but we don't have a Lightning chart up right now. But, you know, there's been significant increase in the amount of Bitcoin used and sent to Lightning Network, which is like great to see. But, you know, again, just like everything possibly pertinent to this change, it doesn't explain all of it. I don't know. It's tricky. And, you know, the kind of like a double-edged sword here, great time to consolidate your UTXOs at this point. And, you know, maybe hopefully not for too much longer, but we obviously want to see like that fee revenue rebound, the mempool, you know, start stacking up transactions, pending transactions again. It all like long-term, this isn't worrying at all. Just kind of an odd anomaly to see this huge contrast between the two halves of the year. But, you know, hopefully at some point it kind of fills back up again. I don't know. I posted a thread on Twitter a bit ago, just like highlighting some of this stuff, specifically like drop in percentage of fee revenue or fee revenue as a percentage of total revenue. And everyone was like attacking me for FUDing Bitcoin and all this stuff. It's like, look, it's, you know, it's something to keep tabs on. I definitely think I'm not going to apologize for posting the data, but it's, you know, this is like, this is kind of abnormal, especially this huge contrast here. I guess so Will had a little bit of a problem with his dog. Oh, we're back. Awesome. I didn't want to jump to Taproot before you got back, but you're back. Sorry, so you can that. Go to Taproot. Do you want to take it away?
For sure. Yeah, the dog has chosen a poor time to make a lot of barking noises. But I want to talk about Taproot, which of course, like if we're looking at Bitcoin in 2021, there's a ton of different narratives we can kind of pick up on. The China ban, obviously one. I think the drop in transaction fees has been a huge underlying data story that we just went over there. I think the next one would be Taproot adoption and how that was kind of picked up from like the flagging process in the spring to it being loaded, locked and loaded in May, and then it going live last month. Zach had a great article that you can find on our website about Taproot and why it matters. But I just want to pitch it back to you guys. I know you guys did some stuff on the State of the Network, your newsletter about Taproot adoption. And I just wanted to get your feel of, did you think it was a successful launch, first upgrade to Bitcoin in 4 years? Any thoughts about the flagging process coming out of it? And any thoughts about the new address type? And if so far you're kind of liking the level of adoption we're seeing across the board? There's a lot of questions, but it's a pretty complex topic. So I want to see where kind of you guys pick it up. Nate, if I could throw that one to you first, I'd be interested to know your thoughts.
Overall, it's gone relatively smooth. Actually, Parker made the point earlier that just the fact that there were no major kind of disasters is always a good thing with the major Bitcoin upgrade, especially being the first one in 4 years. We've seen, I think adoption was slow over the first kind of couple of days and week. It started to pick up recently though. I just looked earlier and it looks like there's over 800 Bitcoin, locked into Taproot now or kind of using Taproot, which is great. And it's such a big change or kind of fundamental change. And I think it'll take a while for it to really ramp up. But I think this is super, super bullish for Bitcoin. And it still hasn't seemed like it's fully sunk in to kind of the larger populace of just how big of an upgrade this actually is.
Yeah, maybe you could walk us through some of the highlights of that upgrade if your game. I think our audience, that'd be awesome for them.
Sure. I can go over it on a really high level. But yeah, I mean, so basically it's kind of the way I like to think of it is it's upgrading kind of Bitcoin's privacy a little bit. I think part of the biggest upgrade is that it's kind of setting the foundation for building kind of more complex applications, decentralized applications and smart contracts on top of Bitcoin. There are various ways it does that. It makes it more efficient to kind of combine complex transactions into one and makes it a little more private and harder to tell what's going on kind of behind the scenes. And then the dApps are interacting as opposed to kind of individual transactions. But yeah, in the long run, it'll basically set it up so we can start building like basic kind of DeFi applications potentially or other type of applications on top of Bitcoin and doing some more complex smart contracting that wasn't really possible before this.
Totally. Yeah. I think the level of adoption was like the Taproot addresses itself is an interesting metric, but here we have a great metric showing like how many nodes have updated and whoever in the crowd is interested in data. This is a great one to bookmark. Luke Dash Jr. is a Bitcoin core developer, a long time, or Luke Dasher, depending on how you prefer to say it. But this kind of shows you how many nodes in the ecosystem have updated to enforce the Taproot rules. And you know, it's over 50% at this point, which is a pretty good metric. And I would be curious to look back at SegWit adoption back in 2017, 2018 and see if there was kind of a similar lagging period or if like the pace of adoption to new nodes is about the same. Kyle, I want to throw the question over to you, though. Looking back over Taproot this year from the flagging process to it going live in November and now post the application going live or the update going live, what has been your takeaways from Taproot? Is the process for upgrading Bitcoin working correctly? Is it decentralized enough? Are the key participants upgrading in time? The only reason I bring up that last point is because there were some pools that flagged that they were upgrading to Taproot, but then didn't implement it till a few blocks afterwards.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, you know, the fact that, again, that we were saying that there were no major delays or anything to the process is obviously a positive. I can't say personally that, you know, I was following kind of the flagging process too closely. But, you know, could throw that back at Parker, I think, who might have better perspective. One thing on the adoption front that is interesting that we were talking about earlier that is, you know, we've seen like Cash App actually say that they're integrating Taproot addresses. So that might actually, if you look at some of the amount of Bitcoin stored by Taproot addresses now, it's kind of, there was a pretty big spike up a couple of days ago. So that might have had some effect. So it'll be interesting to see what entities are adopting going forward.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing here is, you know, we saw like, I think January, February, maybe like overwhelming majority of pools signaling for Taproot. And then obviously we didn't like get the upgrade activated within the first difficulty epoch window there. Second chance or second try did it. But I want to echo, I forget who mentioned it just a minute ago, but like this is sort of like, this is like just very much the beginning and the multi-sig and application development and privacy upgrades potential that Taproot sort of offers the network are huge. And yeah, I like this trend on Google Trends. Thanks, Damien. We see like nobody really talks about Taproot at all. And then like when Taproot went live, huge spike. And now it's just like down to nobody talking about it anymore. And like, it's cool. Like everyone sort of knew Taproot activated and it's here and live and people are upgrading their nodes, I guess, a little bit at a time. But if you can switch back to the node pie chart there, we're barely at like 50%, I guess. So in my opinion, definitely something to watch and kind of sucks as in a time series chart, but want to definitely see that number continue to increase. Like you mentioned, Will, like SegWit, like even like broad SegWit adoption took time. And we'll definitely see the same thing with Taproot. But just like with SegWit, massive potential for increased network use and development and advantages for users. So we want to see that continue to grow, just make sure the trend is, you know, still up and to the right. And so far, you know, pretty good, a little bit slower than maybe the ideal, but it's getting there, I guess. I don't know. I want to jump to actually talking about nodes more specifically. This is obviously a mining live stream. We're going to get to some more mining data in a minute. But any other thoughts on Taproot before we go to nodes themselves? Awesome. So this is one of my favorite and probably the most annoying data set in like Bitcoin for me personally. And it's just, so the methodology is actually private. Luke doesn't disclose that, but this is his best estimate at sort of like an active node count for the Bitcoin network. And it's pretty highly correlated to price movements. At least the green line there, which I think is all nodes. I forget the subset of nodes that the blue line represents lower at the bottom there. The scale obviously kind of screws it up for our view here. But like the bottom line is, you know, a lot of people just aren't running nodes, especially, you know, down from the peak there in 2017, where it looks like he's registering over 20,000 nodes on the network. We're like well below 80 now, or it looks like actually below 70. I don't know, like the more nodes, the more secure the network is, just like the more ASICs online, the more secure the network is. Floor is completely open on this one. I didn't really want to take it in any direction, but I am curious to know your guys' thoughts, how often you think about this, maybe, you know, problems and with curating a data set like this, anything you guys want to talk to about this particular data set.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So we actually get questions about this quite often from some of our clients and other people just asking if we can provide this data set. And we can't. I mean, we could try, but we don't have this data. It's kind of a notoriously difficult one to get just based on kind of like the inherent decentralized and you know, pseudonymous and anonymous properties of the Bitcoin network. There's no real way to get an exact count of nodes at all time. I'm very curious how he's doing this. The one possible way is maybe like if you're running a bunch of nodes in different locations around the world on your own, you can like send messages to other nodes and try and use that to kind of triangulate how many there are and where they are. But yeah, all that being said, I think this is a very important data set, and I wish it's something we had more visibility into, because like when people are asking about Bitcoin's decentralization, nodes is really like probably the most important measure. You know, hash rate and mining power is also super important, but the amount of nodes that are running Bitcoin is super important. And it's a little curious why it's dropped off a little bit. I think you're right, Zach. It's probably just related to price. It might be just because there's like more blockchains you can run now as well, so people spread out a little bit. But overall, I think it's still probably that it's still a pretty good number of nodes if this is accurate. You know, there's like 8K or so. It's a good amount. I think it's still way above Ethereum and pretty much every other blockchain.
Yeah, I think it also speaks to like the profit incentive for mining versus running a node, right? Running a node is always going to be a voluntary behavior, but if you're mining Bitcoin, then you're profit incentivized to keep that machine online as long as possible, make sure that there's a good amount of uptime, at least 95% or higher. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin mining machines online, right? Like the new Riot facility that's going up in Texas right now, it's going to host literally dozens, like thousands of machines. You know, Compass itself is running, I think like we just passed one exahash, like that's thousands of machines too. And that breaks well above like this node count. But yeah, Zach, I think like you're right to point this out, like this chart, it is concerning for the larger network. I would say that most other altcoins struggle with the same thing, right? They struggle to keep nodes online. At least Bitcoin does the courtesy of not overwhelming individuals who are choosing to run a node with a lot of data. But I'll leave the question open for anyone else who has any thoughts on it.
And one thing I'll add is, one thing I'll add is that, you know, obviously, you know, again, kind of a Lightning fanboy here, but it is one of the dangers of making the onboarding experience for Bitcoin so Lightning approach, because there are a lot of user experience challenges with running a Lightning node between channel management and maintaining uptime. So that's definitely, you know, kind of an open area for lots of engineering and problem solving as well. So I think, you know, that may be one of the areas where, you know, that's not showing as much of Bitcoin's adoption as actually is going on. But I would say, you know, that could be reflected in that number as well.
One thing I guess I should add here is, like, I love Luke. I think all of his contributions are, you know, just of massive importance. But at the same time, his methodology is private, and he's a huge advocate for even smaller blocks for the Bitcoin network. So there's a possible incentive there to kind of misconstrue a little bit of this data. You know, the smaller the blocks, the easier it is to run a node. And maybe that number will go up if he gets his way. But I, like Nate mentioned, I am also very curious to know how he gets this data. It is notoriously hard to sort of collect this data accurately. I think it will, like you mentioned, the economic incentives to like run a non-mining node on your own just like aren't there. It's always like an ideological or voluntary thing or a security thing. But yeah, just I think it's fewer people are just doing it. I don't know, Kyle, if you have any other final thoughts to add on this particular trend.
Yeah, and I know BitMEX put out a pretty interesting piece recently comparing the size of Bitcoin and Ethereum nodes. And yeah, I think at the time of writing, you know, it was about 400 gigabytes Bitcoin's blockchain size at this point. So it doesn't seem unreasonable given today's constraints or given today's, you know, off-the-shelf hardware that you can easily acquire. So yeah, I don't think really that's playing a big role, but be interesting to follow, of course.
Yeah, one last comment before we kind of move away to another topic. It's interesting here is that different protocols have taken different designs, and we're seeing those design decisions from years ago walk out in practice now today. One thing I'm thinking about when I'm looking at this Bitcoin node chart is the Ethereum node chart, which has also struggled because of the data bloat size. Again, that same BitMEX piece was actually great, talking about like how big is actually the Ethereum blockchain and how much data do you need to rely on your node. And it's not like a tremendous amount of data, but in some instances, there are like certain pressures you can put on your hardware because Ethereum demands more from its nodes. And one other economic incentive that other chains are taking as well, that's actually going to increase, I think, the amount of nodes on the network going forward, though, that Bitcoin doesn't have, is this desire for fast blockchains to have, for users who are using fast blockchains and trading, to have nodes at their home. So what we're seeing increasingly is a lot of chains like Solana or most notably Ethereum, traders will keep a node for themselves so that they can execute on chain quicker than other traders out there. And that's not something you're going to get with Bitcoin just because of that block time is so low. And like you're settling a transaction, you're not super worried about when it settles. You just want to know that it is going to settle. And I think that in the long term, that could hurt the node count for Bitcoin because there's even less of a profit incentive as compared to some of the other chains. But we'll probably just kind of leave that subject there and move on to a few other charts. I know that you guys brought up some nice charts on ASICs, and I want to throw that over to Kyle. And yeah, Kyle, I think you had a few charts to show up about ASIC prices.
Yeah, actually, I'll throw that back over to Parker with the great background. Oh, this, okay, weird.
Parker, no, this is about, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I'll throw that back over to Parker. He put these together.
So yeah, I think this is Kyle's dashboard here, but if we go back to that PDF slideshow real quick, I can dig into that a little bit. Yeah, one of the questions, you know, we've kind of been thinking about is obviously, you know, Bitmain's rolling out new models of S19s here. I think they're getting 140, 150 terahash per second right now. And that should be coming out near the end of next year. So what we've been trying to figure out is like how quickly will be the uptake in terms of adoption of those new ASICs. And I think, you know, the S9 makes a pretty interesting case study here because there are actually a few metrics we can look at to look for the fingerprint of the S9 on the Bitcoin blockchain and determine what the dominance of that particular ASIC model is. So this chart here just shows some nonce analysis research that has been performed by Coinmetrics in the past. Actually, in the bottom right corner, you can see this is from our State of the Network newsletter. If you guys haven't had the chance to check that out, highly recommend. That's something that Nate and Kyle put out every week. Very quality stuff. but
retweet that.
Absolutely. You can see here on the right, right around the time where S9s were introduced, you started seeing these sort of white bands in the nonce pattern. And for those who don't know what a nonce is, this is basically sort of a random number that is used by miners to introduce entropy when they're trying to solve for a block. And you would think this number would be completely random, but certain ASICs have sort of unexpected behavior when producing these nonces. So based on this first chart, you can kind of identify the dominance of S9s in terms of producing hash on the network. And if we scroll down to this next chart here, you can see how that translates into the actual dominance of the S9 over time. So you could see right around the time where the S9 was introduced, there was actually a little bit of activity on the network already that resembled S9 hash. So you might suspect that, you know, some of the miners were, you know, experimenting a little bit and hashing with those before they were officially released to the public. But that release of the S9 actually coincided with the 2016 halving. And you could see, you know, from there, it was just a blockbuster couple of years for the S9, nearly reaching 80% dominance for a certain period of time. And it sustained that dominance for quite a while up until the point where the S17 was introduced. And that S17 was just a huge leap forward in terms of efficiency and energy usage. So after that, towards mid-2019, you can see the S9 dominance dropping off. And, you know, you would assume that it would have hit zero or much lower than it is soon after. But I think it's interesting that around that time, number one, we had the introduction of Brains OS, which is a minor favorite. It allows you to squeeze a little bit more efficiency out of your S9s. And also we had the halving. And since then, surprisingly, the S9 has maintained a pretty good foothold on the network, ranging between 20, 30, and sometimes 15 or 10%, but it's held its own surprisingly longer than a lot of people would have thought. And it's seen a resurgence in terms of home mining. And if we scroll down a little bit further, we can see this plotted out in terms of the actual revenue that the S9 produces. So again, you can see sort of this pattern here where, you know, the S9 reached its peak dominance and profitability right in between those two halvings. And, you know, it's still hashing along today at $3 or $4 in terms of the daily revenue. You know, we can extrapolate and use average electric prices in the U.S., particularly in the industrial rate, and look and see that the S9 is still quite profitable on a daily basis in many states. So you can get up to $1.50, $2 on a daily basis with the S9. And if you're purchasing these machines for around $500, you're still looking at a ROI period of 8 to 12 months. So it's still very much a relevant ASIC today, despite the fact that so many new ASICs have been recently released after that.
Yeah, thanks so much for this data. I think it's really awesome to look at. And I want to go up one, Damien, if you can, to the kind of the graphic showing the profitability over time. Yeah, the dominance and daily revenue.
That's an awesome chart. I love that chart.
That's a fantastic chart. And so I really want to highlight it now. Like between the two halvings, we have the highest period of revenue for the most dominant ASIC on the market at the time. Like the S17 was obviously coming out or had been on the market for periods of this. But it's interesting to see that kind of dominance in terms of revenue continuing for quite a while. And it's making me wonder, you know, we're at the end of 2021, we're 3 years away from the next halving. How do you see S19s, particularly S19 XPs and other new machines playing into this model you see right here? Could we expect some of the newer Bitmain or Whatsminer machines that have a higher terahash efficiency kind of performing a similar role over the next few years in terms of revenue?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think especially with, you know, all these new advances in terms of squeezing extra efficiency out of your machines. I know, you know, I listen to your Twitter spaces and you probably get 3 questions about emerging mining every time. You know, there's new firmware coming out all the time for these models. So I think the S19 could have an even longer period. I've heard people say, you know, as much as 7 to 10 years. So through quite a few more halvings, possibly.
I guess the thing that comes to mind for me is, you know, S9s are kind of this like iconic piece of hardware that are like, they never die. They either, you know, I guess as the meme goes, go to Venezuela, or like probably more practically, they're also used just for at-home mining. They're a very cheap piece of hardware. And if you don't like expect huge amounts of profit and also want to repurpose the immense amount of heat that they generate, it's probably one of the best for at least getting started with home mining or scaling up your operation. I guess I'm just curious, based on this data, if you sort of expect, similar to what Will was touching on, like, will S9s, should we expect S9s to kind of retain like maybe approximate amount of their hash rate dominance percentage wise they have now, and then the rest of the network just sort of battle back and forth with later models of S17s, the variety of generations of S19s that we see all over the market. But you know, that like baseline load of hash rate, I guess you could call it, from S9s just sort of still staying there. What do you expect trend wise, I guess, with all these different types of machines and then performance upgrades from a variety of different types of firmware upgrades that people are using more and more widely? Any thoughts there, I guess, from Parker or Kyle or Nate, I guess?
Sure. Yeah. Just one last parting thought. I think, you know, like you said, you know, S9s, Venezuela is where they go to die. So I think there will always be a home for S9s as long as they're still hashing. You know, so it's really a question of, you know, hardware reliability. But, you know, if you look at kind of the convergence between the mining sector and the energy sector, you know, you have some natural gas producers out there getting, you know, power for less than half a cent per kilowatt hour. So, you know, at those rates and at these Bitcoin prices today, your production cost for a single coin is only a couple $1,000s. And I think, you know, so those environments are where the S9s are going to continue to thrive. And, you know, I don't see any reason why they, you know, at least in terms of the number of actual S9s, the raw quantity of S9s out there, I don't see that falling off. Maybe their relative hash rate will drop off a bit as new models come online. But yeah, again, just a question of hardware reliability there and, you know, how willing people are to repair their ASICs.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with all that 100%. this chart's just amazing. Thanks for putting this together. I mean, all these charts are awesome, but I definitely have a favorite here. Nate and Kyle, I don't know. Any thoughts on the army of S19 or S9s out there still hashing?
Yeah, I think Parker pretty much nailed it. It's a super interesting point about, especially as kind of Bitcoin mining energy sources get more efficient and it starts hopefully getting more towards renewable energy and other sources. There's almost an incentive to use the cheaper, older hardware, because as long as you're still turning a profit, you can, you can make a good living off that, at least in certain parts of the world. So I agree with Parker. I don't think they're probably going away anytime soon, but the kind of proportion of total S9 hash rate might drop off compared to some of the other ASICs.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that there. Will, do we want to go to mining revenue next? Throw up a couple charts on that.
Yeah, totally. So Kyle put up a few charts as well. I think we should snag those. Thanks for putting those together. So mining revenue has definitely been a bright spot for the market during the entire year. And there's a lot of nuance within this data as well that I'd like to go through. I'm a fanboy of Ethereum, so I think there's actually more interesting stuff to talk about there. Zach might disagree with me though. So, and we are a Bitcoin first company. So, if I get booed off stage, so be it. Kyle, I want to go through these four charts. Can you kind of give us like a lay of the land for mining revenue during 2021, and that we can kind of pick up some insights from there with the rest of the group?
Yeah, sure. So what you can see on screen here is put together some charts, just giving a high level overview of the daily Bitcoin and Ethereum miner revenue. So on the left is data for Bitcoin, on the right is Ethereum. So what I've done here, just in the top left, if we just focus in on Bitcoin, this is just breaking out daily revenue based on the issuance, so the block rewards, and then also the fees. And this again gets back to a discussion that we were having earlier in this live stream about regarding the mempool. And you can see that in red, this is the percent or the total in US dollars fees coming from total revenue coming from fees on from Bitcoin to miners. And then in green is the block rewards. And then in the bottom left, this is a breakout of that same exact data, just in percentage terms. And so what we've done here to just do a direct comparison from Bitcoin to Ethereum, there's some interesting trends going on this year and how we're kind of thinking about Bitcoin mining revenue at Coinmetrics is, you know, kind of looking at it from daily level, looking at it from breaking it out from fees versus the block rewards. So we can kind of dive into some of these charts if you guys have any pointed questions.
I have some pointed thoughts that I'll lob to the group.
Yeah, sure.
It's wild to see Ethereum mining do so well this year. I think the Block ran a nice article earlier this week talking about December's mining revenue for Ethereum. And in the 7 consecutive months, Ethereum mining revenue has outpaced Bitcoin. It's been pretty close, of course, but it's definitely outpaced it. And that's all the same time that Bitcoin has definitely a higher market cap than Ethereum. And I think the easy reason and rationale for why Ethereum mining has been more profitable, or at least higher revenue, is just because of all the different applications that are starting to take off on top of Ethereum. I did an article, I think, back in September about NFTs and how the NFT market was contributing to mining revenue. I'd be curious to get your guys' insights into why Ethereum mining revenue has done so well this year. Can we really just pin it on stable coins, NFTs, and other shit coins, so to speak, pumping up miners' bags?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And yeah, it is a little surprising because, of course, when you think about just from a pure issuance perspective, you know, it's obviously getting one Bitcoin right now is more profitable than getting one Ethereum just on a price basis. But yeah, I mean, part of it is if you look at the data, just the percentage of fees that are percentage of revenue that's coming from fees, you know, earlier in the year, it was almost sometimes even 50%. And if you go down just to the chart right below this, so you can see that it was, you know, at some points in time in this year, greater than 50%. And, you know, even after a major upgrade to Ethereum's fee structure in EIP 1559, which went live in early August, you still, even today, are having about 1/10 of fees of the revenue coming from fees, which is, you know, about 10x Bitcoin's percentage. So yeah, I think, and what is kind of the driving factor behind that? A lot of it, yeah, like you said, is just it really has been just some of this activity in DeFi and especially NFTs. When you get some of these NFT drops, you'll have a lot of bidding wars and people will just bid up, gas prices will go up. And even in kind of the new post EIP 1559 fee mechanism, you'll have people just bidding really high to get their transactions in, and those are going straight into the miners' pockets. So, pretty good time to be an Ethereum miner right now.
That's what I love. Like, kind of, it's always interesting to me about this dynamic, because for how profitable and especially the percentage of revenue coming from fees that Ethereum miners are seeing right now, you just don't hear about Ethereum investors talking about this. There's just still like this huge schism between like the core Ethereum community and then like ostracized Ethereum mining community. When there's so much money going to mining, they just don't want to talk about this because they're all so ready for the proof of stake transition. That's all they're focused on. And, you know, a non-insignificant part of the community lobbing pot shots at Bitcoin for energy consumption and all this sort of stuff. It's just always a really odd, strange dynamic to me to see, you know, the massive amount of mining revenue Ethereum miners are taking in, especially from fees. And I think, yeah, you and Will hit it on the head. It's coming from all this use on the base layer chain. But, you know, the Ethereum community just still doesn't like miners. So I don't know. That's just my two cents.
No, I think those are some great thoughts there, and I'll kind of pick it up. I think you're spot on that the move to proof of stake makes Ethereum miners anxious to kind of talk about how well they've been doing. If you go into some YouTube streams, you can definitely see that they've been rolling in the dough and they're pretty happy to talk about it there. But and maybe it is just like a community difference, right? Ethereum miners are on YouTube. They're not on Twitter. Ethereum core developers are on Twitter. So, you know, there's a little separation there. But I think the proof of stake narrative definitely kind of drives away a little bit of this conversation about Ethereum mining. I think it's also interesting to note that there is not this industrial growth that you see around Bitcoin mining in Ethereum mining, even though the mining revenues have been so high and sustained over the last 7 months. There's some people here and there who are running data centers. Hut 8 runs a GPU farm that they plan on changing to a general computation farm once proof of stake happens. We had American BitPower on a few weeks ago talking about the same kind of thing. But I mean, you're not going to get riot-sized ASIC farms for Ethereum mining just because of this movement to proof of stake. And I think that's just like interesting to see the design decisions from 2015 walking out now in this 2021 bull run. Nate or Parker, I do want to throw this question to you. When you're looking at this, and Parker, you might not have any thoughts on this because, you know, you seem like a lightning Bitcoin guy, but I would be curious to see if you have any thoughts on it at all.
Yeah. I was going to say, as the resident Bitcoiner here, you know, I will add that, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side, because obviously DeFi has sort of been an incredible use case for Ethereum, but with DeFi also comes miner extractable value. It's been really interesting as a Bitcoiner listening to your podcast on that topic. And, you know, we were looking at the Flashbots dashboard earlier. Around 600 million in MEV extracted so far in 2021, which is substantial as far as a component of miner revenue. And, you know, I think, you know, Bitcoiners shouldn't rush to fix this, because there's still a lot of open questions around miner extractable value. You know, that there's bigger incentives for reorgs. There's possibly a regulatory choke point there. You know, it's not quite as clear cut what it means to be a miner anymore, whether or not they're a broker. Obviously, that was a big question with the infrastructure bill this year. So, you know, there are some proposals on the table to add things like drive chains to Bitcoin to boost miner revenue. And I just think, you know, it's better to wait and see, you know, how things work out with Ethereum as far as MEV goes.
Yeah, I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle as well. MEV really took off this year, and mining, as Parker just pointed out, so certain miners are making a killing off that. It could be even more than that. People can essentially take bribes off to the side for reordering transactions, or like front running transactions in DeFi, essentially. So that's huge. And that combined just with like the NFTs. And I think there's something to almost like the casino effect of NFTs. If you look at the fees per block or some of these NFT mints, like if you're looking at daily fees, obviously it's crazy. But if you break it down even more granularly to fees per block, there are certain blocks that just have like an insane amount of fees because an NFT mint is happening or something else. So there's probably some other effect there where like some miners are attracted to that, where just like you can hit it big with a certain block and just like make a killing instantly. But like others, as you guys have pointed out as well, like this won't go on forever, and it'll probably will start to subside relatively soon, especially once ETH 2.0 comes on, but also once things start moving to layer twos, which is already starting to happen. We won't get as many of those kind of ETH minting and ETH trading fees. Same with Uniswap and DeFi, you know, fees coming from DeFi. Those fees will probably start to subside some. MEV is still kind of an open issue, but I'm sure that's going to change and mutate as well. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it changes once the merge actually happens.
Yeah, I agree with that 100% there, especially Parker mentioning, like, you know, it's pretty hard to deny that MEV and everything it represents is super interesting. And just even like having some of these conversations on this stream prior to this year, I've learned a ton about it, because Will is definitely the ether head around here. I try and observe some things from a distance, but it's all like everything MEV is fascinating. It's also just like some of it is just outright scary, especially like properly understanding time bandit attacks. As far as I know, none of them have been like successfully executed at any point in Ether's history, Ethereum's history. But just the theory behind that particular type of MEV prompted attack is like pretty scary for the security of any proof of work network. So I think Bitcoiners also underestimate the amount of MEV that's like available on the Bitcoin chain right now. It's small, but it is there. Definitely not quite the sophistication and like the volume as Ethereum's network, but definitely interesting to watch. And if you're a Bitcoiner who doesn't care about MEV at all, I think that's just a wrong perspective to take. So it definitely should, you should try to make it pique your interest in some capacity. But yeah, some of this stuff is just scary to me. So I don't know. That's all I have to say about it.
Yeah, there's some good research papers out there about MEV on Bitcoin specifically. I think Hasu, James Preswich, and one other author whose name is escaping me right now, wrote a piece about MEV on Bitcoin back in 2019. And I think there's definitely like an unexplored territory on that attack area for Bitcoin. But I think Ethereum is definitely where most of the action is happening. In terms of the arc of the conversation so far, we've generally been going from small scale to big scale. We kind of started off talking about transaction fees, and then we moved on to the machines themselves. And now we're going to move over to pools to kind of wrap up our conversation. I think we do have one graphic, Damien, on pools, if you could throw that up. Yeah, awesome. So we've definitely seen pools change quite a ton. If I showed you this graphic 1 year ago today, and said, this is what the Bitcoin network will look like in a year, I think you probably would have like spit out any water you're drinking or just called me a liar, because no one would have predicted this. Foundry popping into, by some estimates, the top pool, depends on how lucky you are on the day. Probably basically number two pool. Ant pool still there, but definitely had some issues this year as they had to transition a lot of their core infrastructure out of China. And we saw some other pools just kind of disappear. I think a big pool that we should look at, a few pools we should look at, is like Mara pool. I think they're 8% of the network now. There's a few other American pools that we can look at and be like, wow, they have grown tremendously this year. I don't know who's the pool expert among you three, but I would be curious to get your thoughts on this transition and what it looks like going into the next year.
Yeah, Parker, mate, you want to hop on that one?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's just interesting because certainly I think the dynamic in terms of who's contributing to these pools is a lot different. With a lot of the Chinese pools, you know, there's virtually no KYC, whereas with Foundry, this is an institutional mining pool. So most of the people contributing to that pool are probably, you know, well known to Foundry and doxed. And I think it is interesting because, you know, that does present more regulatory attack service once again, but it still hasn't reached the level where it's a super majority of hash power or anything. So, you know, I think it's an open question, certainly.
I would agree there. I think like, you know, Foundry does a ton of cool things, and their strategy for building this pool has been like pretty unique compared to any other of the top pools we've seen over the past couple of years. Major props to them for like what they've achieved and the unique strategy they've taken to like to build this pool, albeit, you know, private and institutional / doxed pool. But like I echo what you said, Will, 100%. Like there's just been a massive shuffle, and like this pie chart doesn't really represent a bunch of, this is kind of like, you know, the calm after the storm. It doesn't represent the massive shuffle and just like collapse in hash rate we've seen from some of these pools over like a 3, 4, 5, 6 week period earlier this year. But yeah, some of them like are, you know, just sort of falling off the pie chart completely, or almost like OKX pool. I don't want to give an exact percentage of what their hash rate was, or their share of hash rate was earlier this year, but you know, at this point, less like barely 0.5% now, according to what we have on the screen, pretty much total collapse, which I guess to some extent, you know, shows the flexibility of pools and how easy it is to transition from a pool you don't like to a comparable pool who may serve you better. There's just been a massive shuffle. And I think, well, I don't know. My question to you guys, I guess, would be like, do you expect any other like big changes, or is this kind of like the pool playing field as we see it distributed here for the, you know, maybe until the next halving or so? I really don't know or have any strong opinions. I think maybe we've probably seen all the shuffling that we will see until the next halving, and just some minor changes, a shuffling around between this sort of group here. But what do you think, Nate and Kyle?
Yeah, I think, it's just crazy, first of all, how much things have changed. I imagine we'll probably still see some changes, at least maybe going into the early part of the new year. So one thing we actually wanted to ask you guys about, so we've seen reports that hash rate in China has effectively dropped to 0%. I don't know how accurate that is or how they can even measure it. Obviously hash rate is moving out of China and going to other countries. Part of the reason why hash rate has bounced back is because people are getting back online. But there's also just a bunch of other ASICs that were kind of waiting around in the background that were going to be coming online anyway, regardless of the whole China thing. So that might be contributing to the hash rate rise as well. So do you think, first of all, has all that hash rate completely moved out of China? Like, is it true that it's 0%? And second of all, from your experience, is it really started to migrate yet and come back online, or is that process still kind of happening?
I can pick up Zach, go ahead, and I'll pick up after.
I wanted to take that data question really quick, because that is one of the most annoying data points that's come out of this huge hash rate shuffle for me this year. It's just blatantly false, and they know it's false. But they, like, no shade, a little bit of shade to the Cambridge guys. I think they do a bunch of cool work, and their data set as like a general reference point for the industry, I think is useful to some extent. But they list their assumptions in that research or that data set. And I think the first assumption just kind of kills the utility of any of the data for any, you know, significant research purposes, that being they base all of the hash rate on IP addresses for miners. And pretty easy to a VPN or other sort of proxy tool to mask where you're mining. And that's where they get the 0% number from. And that obviously got a ton of attention in prior news cycles, you know, 0% hash rate in China. But that number is simply not true. And they're the first assumption they list for their data, in my opinion, kind of neuters the utility of that data. But that's not to say it's not good for, you know, like broad stroke estimates in terms of rankings. Like, we've seen Kazakhstan climb up there, the Cambridge rankings for hash rate, and that's definitely, you know, generally accurate. But more specifically, the 0% hash rate in China is totally false. And I think people should stop using that number, or at least if you're writing about the China trend. Not you specifically, but like other people. I'll stop ranting about it, but I don't like that number at all.
Yeah. That's always suspected as well.
Yeah. So I was talking to a pool operator about this actually yesterday. So it's interesting you mention it, but he said that 30 years ago, the China's Great Firewall also outlawed porn, and Chinese people are still watching it somehow. So I think his point was that, like, people are still hashing in China, regardless of the Great Firewall's attempts to kind of stop Bitcoin mining and Ethereum mining in the region. Like, it's still going to happen. And I think from anecdotal evidence, it's fair to say that anywhere between 10 and 20% of the Bitcoin network's hash rate is still somewhere in China. I was talking about this with Wit, our CEO here at Compass, and that's kind of the number he put on it as well. Of course, we're not going to see that hash rate migration that was in the past. You know, machines would go offline and go between North and South China or vice versa, depending on the part of year you're in. But generally speaking, yeah, that hash rate, it's still present. There's still people plugging in. And that's why the Chinese government is still trying to figure out how to crack down on it. That's why you saw those DDoS attacks, like, I think 2 weeks ago, where the Chinese government is trying to specifically target IP addresses and find where people are still mining. But yeah, definitely like a great question. And it was definitely a great headline for a lot of CNBC articles. We're starting to close out our time here. So I do want to kind of open up some questions for the group. If Damien, we could go to the general screen for us five panelists. This is something we kind of do at the end of the show, just a little 30-second speed round for questions. So I'll ask you a question. Give me like your first response as quick as you can, you know, as accurate as you guys can be with that time. And then we'll pop it over to the next guest. So Parker, how about we start with you and then Kyle and Nate? Parker, where will hash rate be 1 year from now for Bitcoin? And will it be over or under 300 terahash or exahash rather?
I think easily over 300x, all that hash rate that's been sitting dormant in China. You know, obviously we talked about, you know, all the new hash that's been added is probably American or has been in motion already. So I think, you know, easily going to be above 300 exahash, and you know, even if we have a pullback, you know, all of these miners are super well capitalized, so they can withstand it.
Kyle.
Yeah, I think over as well. You know, we saw that earlier this year, the Austin Blockchain Summit. Nick Carter gave a great speech. We saw the political capital in Texas and, you know, other states in the U.S. starting to really open up to Bitcoin mining. So, yeah, I think there are going to be more projects coming online.
Awesome. And Nate?
Yeah, and I'll add to the chorus and say over. Yeah, I still think we are yet to see the true floodgates open for U.S. mining and kind of mining in the Western world.
Okay, awesome. Next question, last one to kind of wrap it up. What will the U.S. hash rate percentage be? And what state will be the second largest, probably behind Texas, for owning hash rate? We'll go reverse order, Nate.
It's a great question. What is it now? Like
U.S. hash 100%. Rate?
Yeah.
Cambridge, I think they put it like 30%. Was that right, Zach?
30%.
Yeah, I think right. So. 30, 35.
I'm going to go with 49%. And after Texas, I don't know. Alaska can be an interesting one. Maybe people will start moving out there. Yeah, I'll go with that.
Awesome. Kyle?
Yeah, I'll go right under 50% too, maybe like 45%. I think New York is still going to be, and I think New York actually was Foundry's number one based off the data that Nick presented in October. So yeah, I don't see any bans coming there anytime soon. So I think New York still.
Parker?
Maybe I'll be a little bit of a contrarian here and say, you know, the U.S. hash rate will remain about the same proportionally, even maybe drop a little bit. I think, you know, for a lot of people, the gut instinct was, you know, okay, it's getting banned in China. You know, America is the safest place to go. But as, you know, more countries like El Salvador and Paraguay become friendlier to mining, I think we'll see more shift out there. And in terms of second largest state after Texas, you know, maybe Oklahoma or Wyoming somewhere with lots of flared gas, I think there's still lots of potential for that. So
totally. I think Zach too. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to agree with Parker. I think... I know some top mining executives out there disagree with me, but maybe they're just shilling their US bags. I think the US will probably stay like below 40% or right around 40% for a while. I think between like North America, I think between the US and Canada, they'll probably be over 50% hash rate between those two jurisdictions. But like Parker said, like China just gave everyone like a massive amount of hash rate or like kicked it out, said go somewhere else. And everyone is realizing like, actually this stuff is pretty valuable. So let's invite miners into our jurisdiction. I think there's going to be, I know there are lots of projects in pretty remote places of the world that are trying to get a ton of hash rate online. But regarding New York, I agree with Kyle. I think New York will still have, you know, a non-significant amount of hash rate relative to other US states. But like, I know for like, it's a weird situation for me. And I know Foundry's data relative to their, or specific to their hash rate shows New York as a leader. But there's a huge chunk of miners that like swear they will never plug in another ASIC in New York. And there's tons of hash rate up there that will still continue to run lots of hydropower and other types of relatively cheap, accessible power up there. So I don't know. New York is kind of an open question in my mind. Just kind of have to see how the other states like Oklahoma, ton of cheap power that people are trying to get. Obviously, Wyoming and Texas. I don't know. It'll be a game to definitely watch. So yeah, longer than 30 seconds, but sorry.
No, great answer. And I think I agree with you. Like New York, between the BitLicense and local representatives not loving Bitcoin, I think that people nowadays, especially in the Bitcoin mining industry, are going to say, hey, like, I'm going to think twice before I park some ASIC somewhere, especially after what happened with China. So I'm pretty pro Wyoming in terms of this. I think there's a lot of excess energy that can be untapped still. Oklahoma, Parker, I think you nailed it there. There's a ton of oil and gas there that can be used for this. And I think we're going to see it pop up throughout the Midwest. But again, I want to thank all you guys for jumping on this stream today. Just very grateful for your time.
Yeah, this has been a super fun conversation. I've learned a ton from you guys. Parker, you make amazing charts. Or Nate and Kyle, if you guys had a hand in that too. Super glad to have you guys on the show. It was a ton of fun. And for everyone watching, all these guys are on Twitter. So definitely throw them a follow. And the Coinmetrics account too. The Coinmetrics newsletters and data updates from their social accounts are super valuable. If you like this conversation, definitely like and subscribe to the channel you're watching it on. It also helps other miners find this content while they're surfing the internet, and makes Will and I feel good about ourselves while we're hosting it. So appreciate you watching and listening, whether you're on the stream or the podcast. Nate, Parker, and Kyle, thank you all so much for coming on the show again. Tell the Coinmetrics team, the rest of the Coinmetrics team, we love you guys. And that's a wrap for today. We'll see you next week for more Compass Live.